Okay, this is David Colburn. I'm interviewing Mr. William Malcolm. It's September 21st, 2010. I'm at his home in Gainesville, and it is about 1:30 in the afternoon. First, Bill, thank you for talking to me, and thanks for your service during the war. We're greatly appreciative. Why don't we start off and you tell me where you were born?
I was born 1,000 feet, 100 yards, let's put it that way, out of the United States, right across the St. Croix River from St. Stephen, New Brunswick, Canada. And, of course, it's very, very nice. It's a lovely area. The St. Croix River is one that I've known for a long, long time and have dug a lot of clams out of the mud and low tides, and have really enjoyed it.
Now, your family, what did your mother and father do?
My mother and father were, they lived in the, could you stop it just a second?
Sure. Okay, we're back and we're talking with Bill Malcolm about his parents. And they lived
in St. Stephen, New Brunswick, where I was born in 1922. That means that I'm 88 years old right now.
Was your father a minister?
Yeah, he was a minister. He was a Presbyterian minister in New Brunswick. And he had been a minister for quite some time, and he was a minister for two more years after I was born. And then he and his wife, moved us down to Connecticut, where he was able to go to I haven't thought of these words, but anyway, he wanted to get his doctorate degree, and that's where he was wanting to do it.
So he was American, but he was...
He was Canadian.
He was Canadian, okay.
He was born in St. John, New Brunswick, which is about 70 miles away from St. Stephen.
Yeah. And your wife, or your mother, excuse me, your mother was a housewife?
She was a housewife.
And brothers and sisters, did you have brothers?
I had two sisters.
Were they older or younger?
My oldest sister was 9 years older, and my second sister, the mid-sister, was just 7 at that time.
How old were you when they moved back to when they moved to Connecticut?
I was 2 years old.
Ah,
I was 2 years old, and we finally ended up. My father got his
doctorate,
and he moved everybody, moved the family from St. Stephen and from. I'm sorry about this, but. He moved his family from our family from
Connecticut,
and we moved to Marshall, Missouri, where I was raised and born.
Where you were raised.
Where I was raised.
Yeah.
And educated.
Oh.
And as a matter of fact, I went from the fourth grade in Marshall, Missouri, to.
Did you do high school, complete high school?
I completed high school and I completed my college. I nearly completed it, but it was granted to me because I was a senior in Missouri Valley College in Marshall, and I my mind just doesn't hold on to everything. But I was in the middle of my senior year in college. When World War II, where the United States encountered the war, and my father said, "We're going to go to I'm sorry.
We're going to go to war. Is that what he said?
No, they took me out to the East Coast of the United States, and he became. A doctor. Well, he was a doctor, but he was a minister there, and he was really very, very happy. My family was very happy there. Although I had lost one of my sisters, she had died. All of a sudden, in St. Stephen, New Brunswick, all of the children, my two sisters and I, had scarlet fever, and she died. My middle sister, who was Phyllis, and my Marjorie, my elder sister, was okay. But Marjorie and I both went through the experience with the...
With scarlet fever?
Scarlet fever.
Mm-hmm. Now, was your father in Marshall, Missouri, a Presbyterian minister there too?
He was, you know, he became a professor of biblical literature and philosophy in Missouri Valley College.
Okay.
And I went through that entire time when I went in as a freshman. But I was a three-year person because I went all time at school.
Well, let me, before we get too far ahead of ourselves, let me just ask you, what was life like growing up in Marshall, Missouri?
I couldn't have choose a better place to grow up because I went to grade school, I went to high school, and I went to college, and I had a lot of friends. It was not a large town, but I think it's a population of something like 8,000. And so I went to... When they got there, I went on to St. John, New Brunswick, where I was accepted by the RCAF.
Again, let's just talk a little bit more about growing up in Marshall. What kind of student were you in those days?
Well, I was a good student. I wasn't I had everything, all of my skills. School work was not A at all, but I did get some A's, but not very many.
And how about athletics? Did you play any sports?
No, I did not play poor sports because my father was nearly killed playing rugby up in Canada, and I just hated it. This idea that he had lost his life and I didn't want to lose my own.
Mm-hmm.
So I did not go out for any of the student athletics.
Now, so when you went to college, what did you major in at college?
I majored in biblical literature and English and...
Did you do any philosophy?
Yeah, well, I guess philosophy, yes.
Okay.
You know, he taught philosophy and went through his...
Did you intend to follow your father's footsteps and become a minister as well?
I did. But when this situation broke out with the World War II going on, I went to the man who was in charge of taking people and putting the young people and putting them in the Army Air Corps. And he did. He put me in and sent me on to Massachusetts, where I went through school and became...
You were in college, you're in your senior year of college, and Japan attacks Pearl Harbor.
Mm-hmm.
Did you have any sense prior to that the United States might be involved in the war? Because, of course, the war was already taking place in Europe, no, and the Canadians were already involved in the war in support of the British.
When I was in the Royal Canadian Air Force, I became... They taught me how to fly, and then I became an instructor.
Did you go into the military before Pearl Harbor was bombed? Did you go in?
No. That was after.
It was after. Okay.
And the United States was going in. And I got in, was accepted in, because I was able to fly. I had taught 15 pilots in the Royal Canadian Air Force. So.
Now, how did you happen to teach flying?
I was a member of the Royal Canadian Air Force, and for about two years, or a year and a half, maybe, I was a flying instructor.
Okay.
After they taught me to fly, they made me a flying instructor.
Now, did they teach you to fly in Canada? Is that where
yes,
you learned?
Yes, that's where I learned to fly.
Okay, and you must have done very well, so that's why they selected you as an instructor.
I guess so. That's it. I had produced 15 pilots for them, and when I left and went back to the United States, I was given a very fine and very pleasant goodbye.
Now, what kind of planes were you flying at that time? What was the model number? Do you recall?
I don't recall, but it was a single engine airplane, not a twin engine.
Mm-hmm.
And I produced 15 pilots for Canada, and when I came back to the United States, they accepted me and. They put me right in, and they said, "We want you to fly, and we don't want to send you over into France and Germany, and we want you to become a fighter pilot." And I did. I became a fighter pilot. I flew 82 missions.
Okay, let me stop you right there.
Okay.
Because you're getting a little far ahead of us. So for 2 years, you trained pilots in Canada. Do you remember
a year and a half? Really.
A year and a half. Do you remember those years? Was that 41 to 42, or was that earlier?
It was about 43 to 44.
Okay. Okay, and then you finished that training program up there, and you joined the American military, the Air Force.
Yeah.
And that was about 44, was it?
That was about 44.
Okay. And you didn't have to go through any training because you'd actually been teaching people to fly.
Well, I did have to go. No, I didn't. They really didn't give me any training to fly the P-47.
Okay.
As a matter of fact, they showed me a movie as to how to fly it. And so that was my instruction. And then I was given a man who was he was responsible for the condition of the airplanes. And he would he showed me how to fly. They gave me a very small airplane. Not they didn't give me the airplane, but they gave me a trainer, and flew me around. And for 2 days, I flew the little airplane. And I made the landings in two or three different airports.
Okay.
And
that was in the northeastern part of the United States.
No, this
was it?
The place started with an M.
Not in the Midwest somewhere?
No, this was on the East Coast.
On the East Coast, okay.
On the East Coast.
Okay.
And they showed me how to fly the P-47 in the flying in the... I wish I could remember the state where I was. But anyway, they just...
Was it Maryland, maybe?
Well, it was...
Not Maryland, no. New Jersey?
No, I could...
Okay.
If I had had a little more time about it, and I would have looked these things up, and I would have been able to talk to you like a human being.
No, you're doing fine.
Oh,
doing fine.
But anyway, they sent me off, and I flew 100 hours. In a P-47 before they sent me overseas to fly combat.
Now, where did they send you?
They sent me to Southern England.
To Southern England, okay.
And they didn't give me any flying time there at all, but they sent me off to France, and they had me fly the airplane for the P-47 for another 100 hours. And...
Now you were when they sent you off to France. This was after Normandy,
yes,
and the American troops had landed in France successfully.
That's correct.
Okay, whereabouts? Do you remember where you were in England before you went to France? Where you were stationed?
Oh, I'd have to look it up on the map.
You're probably somewhere in Southern England, weren't you?
It was in Southern England, exactly.
Mm-hmm.
I could look this up for you. I'll
okay.
I'd make.
And then when you went to France, do you remember the military unit you were stationed with?
358th Fighter Group.
Okay.
The 358th Fighter Group, the 365th, 365th, well, it was a fighter group, I guess, mm-hmm. But they...
And whereabouts in France were you, what was your fighter group stationed? Where were you located?
Could you put that off and I'll look in there.
Okay. Let's see. Okay, we took a bit of a break, but this is David Colburn again, interviewing Bill Malcolm about his experiences in World War II. We left off, he was flying a P-57.
P-47,
I'm sorry. I said 57, didn't I? Right. And he was stationed just outside of Nancy, France. In late 1944.
Mm-hmm.
And we were going to talk about your missions that you were flying out of Nancy into Germany.
Yeah.
Why don't you tell us where you were flying?
And then finally ended up in Germany. It was Mannheim, I guess it was.
Okay. How many missions did you fly?
I flew 82 missions.
82
combat missions. And I flew 200 hours of combat, and I, I flew.
Were you flying, let me ask you this, were you flying in support of bombers, or were you flying in support of?
Ground troop.
Okay.
Yeah, and however, I did see very few airplanes, especially German airplanes, in the air at that time. But I was shot down by ground fire on my 71st and 72nd missions.
Really? And where were you shot down? In Germany itself?
In Germany, yeah. I was, my airplane was flying, just barely holding up. And they had things that hit my airplane just threw it out of possibilities of flying.
Mm-hmm.
And but I had my 2 feet up on the dashboard, and I had my 2 hands on the stick holding the airplane up, and it was just going like that. And finally, if I had let it go forever, it would have just gone boom right straight down into the ground. But anyway, I flew the 82 missions, and
that mission in particular. Did you get back to base, or did you have to crash land?
I had to crash land, and this was on my one day and the next day.
Where were you when you crash landed it? Were you in Germany itself?
I was in Germany, but at that time, our troops were on the ground, and they were in Germany.
And were you picked up by American troops?
Yes, I was there I sat in my airplane once for 2 hours before the troops came through and gave me a ride back to where I was based.
Okay. Were you injured in that?
No, I was not even. I didn't get a scratch, or I didn't lose any blood. I didn't even get a punch in the nose. But anyway, it was...
Well, tell me this. Were you able to land the plane?
Yes, I was able to land it.
And where did you land it?
But I had to land it at 150 miles an hour.
Okay. Land it in a field, or...?
No, it was in both times, both days, the 80th, on my second mission, I was left to go in down onto the ground, and I didn't see any German people until about the last hour that I was there. And he came up, and he was evidently a farmer, and the farmer was probably the man who owned the property that I landed on. But I must say that shortly after that, I was given a instruction to fly to some place in Germany that had thought, they thought that, or they had been told that there were combat airplanes and things like that all on the ground in this area, and they wanted, they said, "Will you go? We would like you to go right low as you can, comfortably, and find out if these combat troops are in this area." So they put me in the airplane, and I flew at combat level and right at treetops. And I was going, and finally I came over a German airfield, and there were a lot of combat airplanes flying. They were on the ground. They didn't know that I was coming because they would have been up in the air. And I went down and I shot one of them, and it looked to me as though I did a lot of damage to the airplane just sitting there. And then I went back up and I went out and I looked around all over this place, and I didn't find any in the area where it was reported. I didn't find any of them there. And so I went back, and very much to my surprise, I was given a Distinguished Flying Cross for doing that. And there's the Distinguished Flying Cross. You can see it right under the lower right-hand corner of the of that.
Oh, yes.
You can see it. It's red, white, and blue.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the Distinguished Flying Cross, and I'm very proud of it. But
you ought to be.
Anyway.
So you were there. This was while you were stationed in Nancy. And then how long were you in Nancy before you went into Mannheim? Looks like he's coming back.
Excuse me.
Okay, this is David Colburn. We just had a brief interruption. I'm back with Bill Malcolm, and we're continuing to talk about his experiences in World War II. He just finished crash landing his P-47 in Germany, was rescued by American troops, and subsequently received the Distinguished Air Medal for Distinguished Flying Cross for his bombing of a German air base and informing American troops how many planes were in the area during that mission. How long you were stationed at Nancy before you moved to Mannheim?
It couldn't have been more than 2 months, I would say.
Mm-hmm. But you flew a lot of missions in those 2 months.
Oh, yes. I did.
Did you fly every day?
No. There were times when you would fly in 2 or 3 days in order, but then they would come back later and give you time off. As a matter of fact, after I went through this thing to tell them where the troops were with their
with their planes.
Materials, yeah.
Yeah.
And my commanding officer said, "Bill, come into my office. I just want to talk to you a minute." And so it turned out to be this. He said, "Bill, you've been through enough right now for a few days. So get on a, we're going to put you on a train and send you down into Switzerland for 3 days off." So I went down there and I had a very, very pleasant time.
Where did you go? Do you remember where you went in Switzerland? Did you go to Geneva or to...
I think it was Geneva, but I'm not sure. Mm-hmm. But the only thing is that sounds so strange is that my wife's name is Geneva.
Oh. You could have gone to Zurich, too, was another possibility, yeah, which is further to the north.
That wasn't it.
Okay. Well, maybe... But, so it was a 3-day R&R, as we used to call it, rest and relaxation.
Yes, that's it.
To R&R. Recover. Yeah.
R&R.
And when you were in Nancy, were you flying in support of American troops at the Battle of the Bulge, or the Battle of the Bulge?
That's the Battle of the Bulge. The Battle of the Bulge was there, and I flew over it and around it and. But I didn't do anything. I didn't strafe anything there on the ground.
Mm-hmm.
But I could tell where the American troops were because they had orange strips that they would put down in front of the troops or with the troops, and you could just see that where the troops were at that time.
And that was to make sure that we didn't shoot at our own men on the ground.
That's right. That's mm-hmm. right.
And were you strafing German trains
yes.
or tanks?
I hit hit one tank, one tank one time, but the train was, well, it was just, it just stopped. And it stopped when I started to strafe it. And when the train stopped, the people just poured out, men just poured out of the trains. And they went in to lie down in the various fields that were near the train.
Was it a troop train? Were the soldiers coming out of the train? Or was this...
I didn't know. I never got mm-hmm. down to see who it was.
Yeah.
And I did talk with the people who did the combat mission, but they didn't know a great deal either.
Mm-hmm.
It may have been that they just didn't want to talk about it. I don't know.
So when you moved forward into Mannheim, how long were you at Mannheim?
Oh, it must have been there about 3 months, two or three months.
So until the war ended, you were mm-hmm. in Mannheim.
Yeah, that's right.
And out of Mannheim, were you flying most days? Or at that point, we were pretty much well into Germany
mm-hmm.
and had defeated most of the German army at that point, hadn't we?
That's true. That's true.
So were you flying on a regular basis?
Not every day,
mm-hmm.
but every 2 or 3 days it would be, I would do it.
And where were you flying to? Were you flying further into Germany?
Yes, farther into Germany and...
And into Austria? Were you flying...
No, there? Didn't go that far.
Okay. Did you do any flying to protect, to defend British troops or Canadian troops to the north?
Mostly I was with the over the Army of the United States.
Okay. And so you stayed there right until May when the war ended.
As a matter of fact, when I was in Mannheim, the war ended.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll never forget the day that I came back and they said, the war is over. The Germans have given up. And I went out all by myself and I just walked on this little road to enjoy the fact that I had made it through the war.
Mm-hmm.
But it was a great experience.
That you were alive.
That
yeah.
I was alive.
Right.
And that I was there without a scratch.
Yeah.
Without a scratch.
Now, did you fly over Berlin at all when you were at Mannheim?
No.
Because that was where area of mostly Russian occupation.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
But I was flying for Pan American World Airways after the war was over. And I remember I was based in Frankfurt, Germany, and would fly many, many times through the along the they had three areas that you could fly.
Oh, you could fly over because of Russian occupation.
Well, this was after the war was over. This was with Pan American World Airways.
Yeah, okay.
And, it was just a...
But as you know, Russia controlled, or the Soviet Union controlled, a lot of the territory around Berlin.
It's true.
So yeah. I'm sure there were only certain routes you could fly.
Well, there were these three routes that we could take. And you had to stay in those routes because the Russians were flying just alongside the
routes
route into Frankfurt into mm-hmm.
Into Berlin.
To Berlin.
Mm-hmm.
And
well, let me get you back to the end of the war. How long? What else did you do? You took this peaceful walk along this road. How long did you stay in Mannheim before you were?
Very shortly.
You okay?
We left and we went back into Germany. Not back into England. And it was
How long were you in England before you went home?
Oh, it was just a very short time. Okay. I don't remember exactly how long it was, but they put us on these. Well, I went in on one Russian ship, and then when they came back home on another, not Russian.
Naval?
Naval, yeah. English.
English ship.
Oh, I'd know the went over on one of them and came back on the other one, but their names were very similar.
Mm-hmm. Was there a lot of celebration? Was there much celebration in Germany, in Mannheim, when the war was over, from the Germans themselves?
Well, yes. As a matter of fact, I remember I was sent out to go along and see if I could find out some information from people who were on the ground, who lived there. And they were very, very friendly. And they would tell us a great deal of information. And, well, I'll never forget talking to one man in Germany, and he said that he was so very thankful that the war was over. And he said, we're very grateful that you have saved so many people, even though you were flying for the United States. And they said, our lives were very much in danger. And, well, that's about it.
What was Mannheim like?
It was a very good city, but the only thing was there was a great deal of damage that had been done by many of the buildings there in that area. And I have one picture of the church in the background, and the steeple was broken in half. And I didn't get close to it, so I didn't see the building itself. But I did remember that.
Mm-hmm.
Well.
Well, yeah, I imagine that the Germans were pleased that the destruction was going to finally stop.
Mm-hmm.
So you get home. What was your rank, by the way? I never did ask your rank.
I was a first lieutenant.
You were a first lieutenant.
I was made, when I came into the Army Air Corps, I was given a first lieutenant rating. It was just begun. They put me in the airplane and let me fly. Mm-hmm. That was the way it went. Well, they did take me around the area where I had the contest, training, and I just remember the area where I was, but there's a lot of damage done on the ground where we were.
Mm-hmm.
Well,
and you got home, and did you come out of the military almost immediately, or did you stay
in? Yes, it was just very, very nearly immediately.
Mm-hmm. And then what? What did you do after that?
Well, I was contacted by Pan American World Airways.
Really?
And they said that, asked me if I wanted to fly for them.
And how did that happen? Where did they get your name?
Well, they didn't get my name. They came into the area and a lot of soldiers were.
Ah, to recruit.
Yeah, to recruit.
Okay.
And to get the people who were flying for Pan American. Of course, we were trained to the point where we could fly very, very comfortably. But
So you went to work almost immediately with Pan Am, did you?
No, not immediately. I think it was in a couple of months. And they told me to go down to Texas. And I don't remember where it was there either, but that's where they had been doing their training,
mm-hmm.
Training pilots for their work with Pan American World Airways.
Now, how had your parents and your sister done during the war? Had they done okay?
Yes, they had. My sister was, they were living in Norfolk, Virginia. And my sister had a job. I've forgotten the name of the business where she was, but it was just a regular company with full clothes and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But my mother and father were very much, well, they were very relieved when the war was over and that, and that I was able to come home.
Was your father still a Presbyterian minister in Norfolk at that time?
Well, it was, no, he had moved down to Texas.
Okay.
And
and were you still single at that time? Or had you married?
I was single that time.
Okay.
It just so happened that I met this, I was going into Kansas City or someplace after the war was over, and I just walked out of an airplane and was going into town, and this woman walked through the gate, and I looked at her and I said, "Your name is don't tell anybody this happened. And she was dressed in a Navy uniform, an officer. She was a naval officer. And Mabel Jean Crane, her name was.
Mabel Jean Crane.
Mabel Jean Crane. And, she said, "Yes, I'm Mabel Jean." And I said, "You are Mabel Jean Crane." She said, "Yes, I am." So she and her family was living in Missouri, back up not far from Marshall.
So you had known her previously?
Oh, yes.
Okay.
I went to school with her.
Okay. Did she recognize you when you recognized
her? Yes, she recognized me, even in my uniform. But, I don't know, it couldn't have been much more than about a couple of months. I asked her to marry me, and she said she would do it.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, Geneva's listening to this story in there, in the other room. And
that's all, you've already told me that.
What?
You've already told me that. I was interested in the war experiences.
Okay.
I knew about that, honey.
Okay. I'm glad you heard it.
And you were married how long?
We were married, I think, about 21 years.
Mm-hmm.
Is that right, Geneva?
I don't know. I was having my own problems.
Okay. But she was a, it to, so happened that she was a naval insurance, and what do you call a person who is doing very, very, well, work about what's being done against our people.
Oh, she was in the Secret Service?
The Secret Service, but she was a
naval officer.
Naval officer.
Okay.
And she lived until, I don't know how long it was, but she died of mm-hmm. pancreatic cancer.
Mm-hmm.
And
did you have children?
No. We have no had no children.
Mm-hmm. And
I'm married. Married.
Geneva.
Geneva. Geneva, and she had three sons, and they married, and they've got two of them have two sons, two children, a boy and a girl, and so I automatically became a father for the Wilmot family, mm-hmm. which was Geneva's name.
Mm-hmm. And tell me, how many years did you fly for Pan Am?
4 months short of 36 years.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah. And lived in Frankfurt, Germany, and in Medellin, Colombia, and Hong Kong, and flying in these various places, but also in we lived in Massachusetts.
So your World War II experiences opened up the whole world for you, didn't it?
Oh, it certainly did, yes.
Yeah. By What kind of planes did you fly for Pan Am? Did you fly the DC-7?
I started with the DC-3.
Okay.
And then the... I flew for Pan American out of Miami, Florida, and out of Frankfurt, Germany, and out of Hong Kong, and was based in those three places where they flew.
And initially, I guess you were flying the propeller-driven planes.
Yes.
But ultimately, you ended up flying jets, didn't you?
Oh, yes, I ended up flying a 747.
Did you really?
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, it was a great airplane, and it was the biggest airplane I flew.
Well, you had quite a career, didn't you?
And I ended up with 22,000 hours.
Ever had any problems in the air in all those years of flying?
Well, I was ready to fly out of New York City, and we finally said to the passengers, go on board. So they all came on board, and we were just about ready to start engines, and the purser came up and she said, a man had just said to the people, to some of our passengers, this flight is going to end up on the bottom of the ocean. So I said, we had started one of our engines, and so we said, cut the engine, and we'll stay right here on the ramp. And I went in to talk to the police, and they came out, and they took him off the airplane, got him out of the place, and they also took everything that he had in the
all his luggage and everything.
Where all the luggage was, just because we knew that if it was going to end, had been said like that, we were not good. We were going to. So they went through all of the luggage on the airplane, the things that were in the cabin with the crew, with the passengers, and they didn't find anything. But that was quite an experience.
Mm-hmm. How was it flying for Pan Am in those years? Was it quite exciting? And
oh, it was wonderful.
Was it a good job?
Pan American was a wonderful company to work for. And they sent me to various parts of the world. And I just wouldn't change one thing that I had done. And then when I married Geneva, I knew that I had done it. Again, that I had done any other right thing. And she's a wonderful woman. Did you hear me say that?
I guess it was quite a shock to you that Pan Am went out of business at some point.
Oh, I was very disappointed because I was not part of Pan American at that time.
Mm-hmm.
I had been... I retired, and well, it was just a wonderful thing that I had to say goodbye to all of these wonderful guys I've been flying with and people I've been working for and all that sort of thing. And one of my finest trips was when I was flying a DC-6 or DC-7, I'm not sure which. But anyway, I was sent by Pan American to go all around Europe and anywhere in the world, down into South America, whatever, to pick up people and bring up American people and bring them out of these dangerous places where they were. And so that was one of my greatest experiences, was to take those people. And I remember... when I said I had the PA system on in the cabin, and we were ready to go out over the ocean when I was bringing people out of Germany, and I said, ladies and gentlemen, it's the captain speaking. I just want to let you know that we are now flying over the Atlantic Ocean back to our wonderful United States. and I could hear cheers in the cockpit about these people who were so happy to, and mm-hmm. thankful to have been taken from this situation. Mm-hmm. And
so you did that all over the world to all of the hot spots.
Well, I did. It just so happened that it wasn't all over the world, but it was South America, Europe.
Did you go into Africa at all?
Yes, I flew into Africa, but this was not to pick up passengers who were in danger.
Mm-hmm.
But I remember one time, just after I had gotten back into Canada, into the United States, where was it? I guess we were living in
Iran.
What?
You haven't told him about Iran.
Iran. Yeah.
Bringing all those people out.
Yeah. Okay.
This was the Iran hostage.
Yes, the Iran
crisis
hostage.
When you went.
Yeah. So, as a matter of fact, when I got home. And there were people who, I guess they must have lived here in Gainesville, but they called me on the phone, and they thanked me for it because they said that they had been on my flight,
mm-hmm.
and
this was after Ronald Reagan became president.
Yes,
and Jimmy Carter had been trying to negotiate the release of the.
Yes.
Americans held hostage there.
That's right. And as a matter of fact, I had to call in as I was on my way back into the United States. I called I wanted to talk to the White House. And I didn't get a chance to talk to Jimmy Carter, but he was very appreciative of what we had done, Pan American, mm-hmm. and my crew and I were there, and we were had they been doing whatever we could do to bring people out.
Mm-hmm.
And one day, the phone rang, and I was living in
were you in New England?
No, I was in. It was just an hour out of New York to this place in Connecticut.
Oh, in New Haven, maybe?
Well, no, it wasn't. It was...
Stamford?
No.
Not Greenwich. Hartford. Maybe Hartford?
Not far from Hartford.
Okay.
It wasn't far from Hartford. And they said, we just got calling to thank you for bringing us back to the United States. And
that's why we have the picture in here of the four of us.
Oh, I see.
Yes.
Of the what?
Of the four of us, both he and his wife.
Yeah.
And you and I.
Mm-hmm.
There's a picture in there.
Yeah. Well, we can show you that.
Well, tell me about, as you look back on your war experiences, how would you describe your experiences in World War II? What did it mean to your life?
I never was really scared. I don't know, there was something about it that I would get into the airplane. My engineer, flight engineer, would lean in the cockpit, and I would just watch it, and he'd see everything was okay. Then he'd run over out the wing and jump off. And I was never, ever really overreacting to what could happen to me in these flying experiences and the strafing experiences. And, I was just very thankful to be able to be a part of it.
Yeah, was it a positive experience? Did you look back on it and say we did something right for the world?
Oh yes, I would look back and say that to myself, or say that to my parents and my wife after I had married her.
Mm-hmm.
And I've said the same sort of thing to this individual who's looking out through the window, through the door. And no, I was never really just so terribly scared that I was nervous.
Mm-hmm.
And I just didn't get that and flew every one of those 85 or 82 combat units.
What was the P-47 like to fly?
Wonderful. It was absolutely wonderful. It was as heavy as a DC-3.
Wow.
And it was amazing that what that airplane could do. It's a great airplane, and I'm so thankful for the P-47.
Mm-hmm.
Because I made it.
Now, was there...
And I'm here talking to you. That's the way I usually say it. And I talked to her, too, because she's listening in. Come on out here.
Well, I'm just thrilled because I'm hearing things that you haven't told me.
Oh.
And you've told me a lot of things that you haven't told him.
At the end of the war, the Germans had started to develop rockets or to use rockets, mm-hmm. and they were firing those rockets at Great Britain.
Mm-hmm.
Were you ever warned or cautioned about these rockets being a danger to you and your unit, to your squadron?
They never really ever said that. Pan American just would put the passengers on board and...
Well, no, not at Pan American. I'm talking about when you're flying... in the war, in the P-47s, when the right at the end of the war, the Germans had rockets they were firing into Great Britain.
Yeah, I remember that, but it didn't affect us.
Yeah, and you commented, which is really quite interesting, that you never did you ever have an air fight with another German fighter plane?
I saw very little of the German Luftwaffe, and I only encountered the Luftwaffe at one time in the air. I wasn't able to shoot it down, but I fired at it, and I think I must have damaged it somewhat. But really, the fact that the Luftwaffe was not in the war.
By the time you, after you left, after you did your training for the Canadian Air Force, then went with the American Air Force, and then went to Europe, it was late in 1944, and so much of the German, I guess, Air Force had been destroyed by that point.
Well, much of it had been. And one of the world, the days I will never, ever forget was when I came back from a combat unit to flight, and combat mission.
Mm-hmm.
And I heard that the war was over, and here I was over in Germany. I was had just flown a combat mission, and the war was over. And I'll never forget walking out on this country road, all by myself, and giving thanks, and just having a wonderful feeling of myself about living through this war.
Mm-hmm. Did any of the men? Did you lose any men in your squadron?
Oh yes, I lost three good friends.
Ah.
One of them was his name was. Oh, I know his name so well, but I was so thankful that they. Well, they were just shot down, and that was it.
And was he flying a P-47 also?
Yes, they were flying P-47s. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh.
So you folks were, I mean, just because the wall was winding down, you folks were at considerable risk every time you went up.
Oh, well, we were at risk when we were out walking all by ourselves in the country. Because... Well, I'll never forget talking to this woman about who told us about how thankful she was that the war was over and they didn't have to worry about their homes and the German army people coming in and spending the night or in rain or something like that. And they were so thankful that they had nothing to do with those people anymore.
When you were stationed in Nancy, France, did you have much contact with the French people?
No. didn't speak French.
Mm-hmm.
But we were just on our own property, that is, mm-hmm. where our runways were.
Air base.
Mm-hmm. Air base was.
Mm-hmm.
Oh.
Well, Bill, thank you. Thank you for this opportunity to talk to you.
Well, I wish that I'd had more time to get stuff together, but...
Well, we can, you know, if you want to get some things together and just let me know, and I can come back out and we can talk a bit more if you'd like.
Honey, there's a book, you know.
What?
There's the book that the boys put together. I don't know whether it's been published or not, but it's all, you know, the white book that Larry and Graham got together of all. They read all of it. Here's a big stuff of... Things of people that know him, and what he did, scrapbook, mm-hmm. yes. And they got that all together and mm-hmm. put it together as a book. It's very nice.
Let me show you a book.
I'm going to go ahead and stop this tape right now,
all right.
Bill, if that's okay.
Yeah.